open it. Could you all make sure your phones are turned off for the event? And I should tell you that there are quite a few people who are going to be coming in late. So if you've left seats in the middle, could you probably move in? There are quite a few more badges. I'm sorry if you have friends who haven't been able to come today. We already have people downstairs who are quite irate, so those of you who are here should be very happy. I'm very happy you're here too. But this has made it. Popularity is fun, but it's not exactly what you always wish for in this particular case. I just thought we'd get started because we have a very tight program, and I wasn't meant to say anything, but I just realized mobile phones off, please, or on silent. I think I would like to introduce, this is, when you organize an event like this, you forget little things. And the one is that, of course, I should be introducing the guest speaker, or making introductory remarks, but I think I might. We all know so much about Dr. Saad Iskander. He is perhaps one of the most well-known people who've been working in Iraq in the last 10 years and has many friends probably in this room. And so without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Saad Iskander.
Good morning. It's a great pleasure for me to be here with you this morning in this important conference in which many well-known scholars from Britain, Iraq, and elsewhere participate. I would truly like to thank the organizers, the British Academy and the British Institute for the Study of Iraq. And I want to seize this opportunity to thank the British Institute for the Study of Iraq, for their support of Iraqi National Library and Archive. A lot has been said about Ms. Bell as an explorer, as an archaeologist, and as a linguist, and most importantly, as a political officer. And I am sure a lot will be said about her in the future. She was a remarkable person who played a distinctive role in an exceptional place and enduring an exceptional historical period, a period which witnessed the political emergence and the cultural revival of the modern Middle East. In many ways, the emergence of modern Iraq is in particular associated with Ms. Bell. Regardless of our understanding of her role, I am one of those who are very critical of her political thinking and political role in Iraq. But at the same time, I highly admire her contribution to the preservation of Iraqi cultural heritage. In the Arab Middle East, especially Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, T.E. Lawrence has a prominent place in the memory of its people. But in Iraq, it's only Ms. Bell who occupies an exceptional place, both in the imagination of its ordinary people and in the mind of its cultural and political elites. Iraqis have never forgotten her. As Iraqi academic journals, Iraqi newspaper, Iraqi website always mention her and write about her role in Iraq. It can be argued that the political and cultural legacy which Bell left behind in Iraq exceeded by far those of other Orientalist and British imperial officials who served in the Middle East during and after the First World War. In her diary dated 30th January 1922, she wrote that, "I am more a citizen of Baghdad than many of than many a Baghdadi getting older. I will repeat the quotation. I am more a citizen of Baghdad than many a Baghdadi born. I will wager that no Baghdadi cares more or half so much for the beauty of the river or palms gardens or clings more closely to the rights of citizenship which I have acquired. This is a controversial statement which can be interpreted in totally different ways as outright imperialist orientalism or simply a true sentiment of affection from a foreigner who decided to dedicate her energy and her time for adopted country. When it comes to Al Khatun, her nickname in Baghdad, or Koksa Khatun, as many nomad and Arabs who lived in faraway places called her. Iraqis tend to mix historical reality with mythological tales, politics with culture, and idealism with pragmatism. This state of affairs directly reflects a paradox, a true concern for the future of Iraq, her adopted homeland on the one hand, and her role as an imperial official who had to consolidate the interest of her native country on the other hand. It also reflects the contradiction between personal and impersonal dimensions or considerations, namely her own ambitions and characteristics and Britain's imperial strategic interests. At that time, Iraqi newspaper described Bell's death as a great loss to the world of science and the world of politics, highly appreciating her contribution and services to the newly born Iraq. Her role was viewed as a bridge between the British and the Iraqis. In my view, regardless of our assessments, Bell's personality and contribution have become part of both Iraq's cultural heritage and Iraq's historical memory. Indeed, one cannot talk about the setting up of the Iraqi Museum, the establishment of the Iraqi National Library, the formation of a native critical class, and the making of the Iraqi state itself without mentioning the key role Bell played at the time. From a historiographic point of view, Bell was seen by the Iraqis as both controversial and paradoxical figure. We, the Iraqis, still argue about her personality and her role in the making of modern Iraq and the problems associated with the process of state building and nation creation. Indeed, different communities and scholars from different ideological backgrounds have a contradictory views in Bell's personality and her cultural and political contribution. Since the event of April 2003, we the Iraqis have been dealing with the issues our fathers and grandfathers faced in the period that followed the end of the First World War. Modernity versus traditionalism, secularism versus religious beliefs, we have been encountering almost the same challenges the Iraqis faced when Bell was in Baghdad. Lack of consensus, political fragmentation, economic regression, complicated social division, and an absence of a national identity. For the above-mentioned reasons, when exploring Bell's role, one must approach it from different angles, as this international conference is trying to achieve through the diversity of the topics of its sessions. I am sure the participants in their academic contributions, and their academic contribution will create an objective picture of the role Bill played during her life in Baghdad. At the end, I do hope that the National Library and Archive will hold similar conference for Bill in Baghdad. After all, Bill was a citizen of Baghdad, like me, Dr. Alawi, Dr. Tamara, and Dr. Lamia. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Hello, my name is Cida Maiden. I'm coming from Turkey, 26 years old, graduated from the History Department with a first degree, and this is the, actually I am the one who study on Gertrude Bell in Turkey. The first one, so let's just start. Born in AD 68, rich family, she is very, very talented, finished the Oxford Modern History with a first degree. So she gave a signal she will be the one who just paved the way with Iraq future. So when we come to Istanbul and to the soils of the Turkey, we can see that her uncle, Frank Lascelles, was the British minister at Bucharest, and she came there. Talking to important person increased her curiosity towards the Ottoman Empire and the Ottoman politics. So she went to Istanbul in this date, 1889. So the very first things they said about the Turkish people, the people are so fearful, sophisticated, they address you in a very bad English. This is the first thing that you should know about Gertrude Bell. She is very sarcastic about the most serious events. She has a sense of humor. So this is maybe the most striking feature of her that really affects me. And second thing that you should know about Gertrude Bell, her lack of emotion always led her to work so much hard. So this is lack of emotional relations leading to work more, let's say investigate more. So another trip to Turkey was a year ago. Says that about the Turkey. I feel that I could stand from till next week at the end of the Galata Bridge and watch the people pass and never be bored for a moment. So she likes Istanbul, she likes Turkey, but also very controversial thoughts about the Sultan of the Turkey to Sultan of the Ottoman Empire. So as you can see, they come to Turkey in third times in 3 May with her father. Says that Papa and I went to Süleymaniye, very magnificent, then Rustem Pasha Mosque, then Şehzade. We done it at Pera Palace. So this travel was for travel purpose and no suspicion of the government allows yet. But the year of 1909 was a very important milestone because Gertrude Bell's feelings towards the Ottoman Empire just changed. She became really obsessed with the Ottoman politics, so as the Ottoman Empire became very suspicious about her travels. So this is her picture from Lebanon. There's a lots of pictures, as you know. Thousands and thousands, unfortunately, I cannot put everything. So 1905 is another important period for both of the Ottoman Empire and also for Gertrude Bell, because her travels started the suspicions of the government towards her. She said that, "I find the government has been in agony of nervousness all the time. I was in the Jabal Rus, this is a place in Syria. They had 3 telegrams away from Sahat about me, and they sat and wondered what I was going to do the next." Also, she says, "I have found that while I was in Damascus, every time I went out alone, I was followed by a man who was conscious to watch over my safety. Also, the Turkish government has decided that I am a great swell and nothing will persuade them to the contrary." So the Gertrude Bell was very known that she is a suspicious person and the government has bad thoughts about her. So this is the Gertrude Bell's house, where she stands in the Turkey, sees that the conditions are very bad, the house is very bad. Another trip to the soils of Turkey in 1905 was at Konya, and she says that, "What a country this is. I feel I shall spend the rest of my life by traveling in it." So she has a deep affection to the soils of Turkey, to the lands of the Ottoman Empire. In Turkey, she met very important persons that will played vital roles in her career. For example, one of them was archaeologist William Ramsay. Then the two one will work on 1001 Church, that she wrote a book about it. So in May, she was also in Istanbul and met with the Osman Hamdi. As you know, he has a picture about the turtle, the guy with the turtle. He was a director of Istanbul Archaeology Museum. She showed him findings, and also Osman Hamdi showed her what the Ottoman Empire has about the archaeology. She also joined a ceremony, Friday Mosque, as a religious ceremony in Ottoman Empire. So one of the pictures. So this is two of her servants, Fatuh and Faris. There are tons of pictures of them, but unfortunately I just add a little bit. So this is her camp around Corona. So you can see that the conditions are very bad. See that the camp area is with blood everywhere. She wrote a book about Syria and also the Ottoman Empire. The name was The Desert and the Sound. The important places that I'm reading, this is from the book Desert and the Sound. "The Turkish peasant, he is gifted with many virtues, with the virtue of the hospitality beyond all others. Being English, I am persuaded that we are the people who could best have taken Syria in the hand with the prospect of a success greater than that which may be attained by a moderately reasonable sultan." So she gave the signal of that we should take Syria and the Middle East territories. She also complains about the disappearance of English influence in the Ottoman Empire. She says that the root of it lies in the disappearance of English influence at Constantinople. "The position of authority that we occupied has been taken by another. I believe a considerable amount of goodwill within the Turkish Empire and the memories of an ancient friendship. It should not be impossible to recapture the place we lost." She complains about the increased influence of German in the Ottoman Empire. In the Ottoman Empire, she wrote massively about the churches, Byzantine and Roman churches. She made lots of excavations about it. And of course, her travels raised suspicion too. She wrote that, "The government has been much exercised about me. The governor sent a telegram to the Mutasarov to say an English woman was prospecting the country and he was to keep his eye on her." This is the exact document that she talked about, written in the Ottoman Turkish. It says that English woman named Miss Bell traveled Central Asia, and it is known that she has taught against caliphate and Islam. She also wrote a book about Syria, means desert and Islam. In the letters that she sent and in the book she wrote, although it is clear that she has taught against the empire, the opportunity to travel within the empire's territory should be given to her. So the Ottoman Empire was well realized her intention, actually, and also did not, did not try to close her way, so gave permissions about her. So this is a very important event. 22 May of 1909. She was camping a village near Midyat. Was purely archaeological purposes, but she was robbed. She put the event as, in the middle of the night, rustling robbed me. I woke up and saw a man crouching in my tent. I look up and saw a man, I showed every figure outline against the sky. So, all in all, I can say that she was robbed. All the things, all the photographs, all the sketches, plans, all the money that she has, had just gone. The more I thought of finished works, the more miserable I became. This is the last word that she put. When she robbed, the Ottoman government sent 10 soldiers and the other day 50 infantry. What makes this event is important is the Times and the other newspapers published the incident. They gave the full description of the event and added that everything except the money was recovered. Another scholar is Winston wrote in his book, says that the saddlebags were found with all their contents except the money, which was later refunded by the Ottoman authority. And also another, so this is the pictures. The soldiers sent after the battle. So this is the photo taken by the Ottoman personally. So this is the document, the official document, that says that the money of Gertrude Bell was also refunded by the Ottoman Empire. The information was taken from the ambassador of England that the belongings, animals, and the money of Miss Bell, who is part of the reputable family in England, were stolen when she was coming from England. In order to prevent this event to happen again, necessary precautions should be taken and the unrobbed property should be returned. So the money also was returned. So 1911 was an important time for Gertrude Bell because she met Thomas Edward Lawrence, who became the company in the Arab Revolution. I'm just passing very fast because there is so much to talk, so I'll try to keep the time. There was a man who was married also, name was Dr. Riley, and Gertrude Bell has feelings towards him. This is the two sides of feelings. He also loved Gertrude Bell. He went to Albania, and she chose travels as a means to escape. As I said at first, lack of emotional relations and also feeling of loneliness always drives her to travel a lot, search a lot. So in 1913, she departed to East. Her intention was to meet Ibn Rushd and Ibn Saud. These are the important tribal leaders, Chase. Her route was to Hale. This is a place in Central Arabia. The Ottoman Empire, of course, was very anxious about her. It seems that they have been looking for me everywhere and telegraphing from Constantinople. So this is the official document taken from the Ottoman archives about the event. A woman named Miss Bell, subject of England, planned to meet Ibn Rushd at Sud territories. She plans to depart from Damascus tomorrow with 20 camels, personal guards, and guides. It is also known that she is a British spy whose salary is £5,000. So this is important that the Ottoman government exactly know or just think that she is the spy of the British government. So within the territory which she will be traveling, there are lots of dangerous traps and it's quite possible that she can be attacked. So her travels should be prevented via embassy. This is another document says that we have been informed that the ambassador of England will order Miss Bell via the telegraph of the Consul of Damascus that she should give up the traveling to Central Arabia. So the Ottoman government did his best to prevent her from traveling, but of course she did not listen. In fact, the Ottoman government also informed the British Embassy at Constantinople about her situation, and Louis Mallet, the British ambassador in Constantinople, warned her if she continued her travels, not only the Ottoman government, but also the British Empire would not be responsible for her safety, but also the British Empire did not want her to go because the road was very dangerous. She reached Halle, the capital of Ibn Rushd. She was taken prisoner for 11 days. The more she stayed there, she realized that how much the Rushd family was full of intrigues. And during her stay in Halle, she created a point of view that would affect even the policy of the British Empire. She highly recommended the British Empire that we should support Ibn Saud and his power. So this is her caravan at Halle. You see the camels. This is the place where she was kept for 11 days. Now she was 44, her interests changed from archaeology to the politics, especially the politics of the Ottoman Empire. Later at the end of the 1912, to her friends, she wrote, "My preoccupation now is Asiatic Turkey. What will happen now that the Ottoman prestige had vanished into thin air? It's a curious problem, and I should not be surprised if we were to see in the course of the next 10 years the break of the empire in Asia and the rise of the first Arab autonomies." She was a good observer and saw the future of Central Arabia. Also, she wrote an article about the Ottoman Empire to the Times named "The Danger in Asia." She described herself linked to the Ottoman people with affectionate intercourse, so she also likes the people of Ottoman Empire. It is certain that the Arab provinces, which had been held by military prestige, must struggle towards some form of autonomy now that the prestige had disappeared. What chance is there now for a peaceful solution? Turkey is poised on the brink of chaos, and I do not know what helping hand can be held out to her, because I do not believe that the under existing conditions help would be accepted. The quality, in spite of their Western culture, are at heart more barbarian European than the oldest of the old Turks. Governing directly or controlling as overlord was no alternative to the Turks in Asia, except European occupation. Which of the nations of Europe is prepared to shoulder the burden or contented to see it is shouldered by another? I write under the impact of sorrow. She also likes the British or European occupation and also very thoughtful about the results of this occupation. So she has a really vision to see the future, actually. Her next stop was the Constantinople after the Central Arabian travels, and where she met Louis Mallet, the British ambassador in Constantinople, and the other people's politicians, correspondents. She told him all of her experiences, evaluations. So he wired to this information to Sir Edward Grey, the Foreign Secretary of England, that will constitute the foreign policy of the British. So her travels, her observations about the politics in the Ottoman Empire actually constituted the future policy of the British Empire. So this is it. Thank you very much.
Presentation will have a 30 minutes for a question and answer. Unfortunately, one of our panelists, Professor Peter Slowlett, will not be with us this morning due to health problems. Dr. Ali Allahi, my colleague, will read his paper.
Thank you, Dr. Skander. Just before I start on reading some Peter's paper, I just want to make one or two comments about him for those who might not know him. And this is really an informed personal appreciation for him. He's, as you might know, one of the pioneers of the study of modern Iraqi history and historiography. And his PhD thesis, which was then turned into a book, is still in print and it's outside. With his late wife, Marion, he wrote also one of the standard texts of modern Iraqi history, the history of Iraq from 1958. And he's been one of the most prominent academics in the field of Middle Eastern history, being a professor at Durham and then at the University of Utah, and subsequently at the National University of Singapore, where he's now a research professor. He asked me to convey his personal greetings to the conference, and I shall read out his paper now, which is entitled Gertrude Bell and the Ottoman Empire. As far as I know, Gertrude Bell was the only senior member of the Mesopotamian administration to have had any experience of life in the Ottoman provinces before the First World War. Percy Cox had spent most of his career in Persia and the Gulf, although he had been involved with the negotiations leading up to the Anglo-Ottoman Convention of 1913. Before coming to Iraq, Arnold Wilson had spent his career in India, southwest Persia, and the Gulf. Rita Ballard is probably the main exception, as he had served in Constantinople, Trebizond, and Erzurum between 1907 and 1914, where he was posted to the consulate in Basra and subsequently in Baghdad and Kirkuk. In contrast, Gertrude Bell had made extensive visits to various parts of the Arab world, beginning with a visit to Palestine and Syria in 1899 to 1900. She also traveled extensively in Syria and Iraq in the 1900s, as described in her book, Syria, Desert and the Sun, 1907, and From Amarath to Amarath, 1911, and made an epic and evidently quite risky visit to the Rashidi capital of Hail in 1913. In addition to writing her travel books and maintaining a very substantial correspondence, Bell made maps and topographical gazetteers of parts of the, quote, Fertile Crescent and the sparsely inhabited areas to the south of it, roughly northern Hejaz, Najd, and the eastern part of what is now Saudi Arabia. This area had been little mapped by European geographers, either civilian or military, and it became increasingly desirable for British and German and Austrian military and intelligence purposes in the early years of the 20th century that it should be. In addition to Bell, her two younger contemporaries, T. Lawrence, 1888 to 1935, Two Timing as an archaeologist, and William Shakespeare, 1878 to 1915, also made maps and surveys of various parts of, quote, Arabia. Bell had a certain amount of private funding, but others were salaried government employees. They were not gentlemen of leisure, with no need of support or direction, or more mundanely, of financial support. Only a very few travelers, such as the more eccentric Mark Sykes, 1879 to 1919, and Aubrey Herbert, 1886 to 1923, fell into this category. And it is also true that, like Bell, Mark Sykes was both independently wealthy and well-connected with members of the British establishment, who were well placed to promote or at least make arguments for the soundness of his opinion. A rather glamorized version of some of these activities appears in Prior Satir's lively Spies in Arabia, the Great War and the Cultural Foundations of Britain's Covert Empire in the Middle East. What is important for our purposes is that much of the wartime and post-war discussion over the future of what might be called the Eastern Arab world was largely informed by the experiences, reports, and opinions of these and a very few other individuals. In particular, their opinions seems to have been very largely responsible for the elaboration of the notion that the, quote, Arabs had long been eager, and here I exaggerate to make the point, to throw off the Ottoman yoke. By the early 20th century, in terms of territorial extent, the Ottoman Empire had certainly dwindled to a shadow of what it had been a century earlier. Egypt had become more or less independent of Istanbul, the first under Muhammad Ali and his family in the 1810s, and then under British occupation in 1882. By the Russo-Turkish War of 1877 to 1878, Bulgaria, Montenegro, Romania, and Serbia became or would shortly become independent states. Bosnia-Herzegovina was annexed by the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and parts of eastern Anatolia were annexed by Russia. On the eve of the First World War, the Ottoman Empire had lost all its territories in the Balkans, except eastern Thrace, which is still part of the Turkish Republic. As a result of various conflicts in Europe, some 5 million Muslims were either killed or left their former homes and fled to the Asiatic part of the Ottoman Empire. At more or less the same time, beginning with the dissolution of the Janissaries in 1826, the empire embarked on a long-term reform program, culminating with the admittedly somewhat hasty and confused promulgation of a constitution in 1876, beginning with the Khatt-i Sharif of 1839, a series of reforms were enacted, covering such diverse fields as administration, education, civil, commercial, criminal, and personal status laws, the rights of minorities, military organization, land ownership, and taxation. In consequence, by the beginning of the 20th century, more than 500,000 Ottoman civil servants managed activities commonly associated with nation states, from the administration of hospitals to the construction and maintenance of essential infrastructure. Although any such comparisons are speculative, the Ottoman state in 1900 was most probably no more, quote, backward than Mexico or Peru or even Spain and Portugal. All these states in company with Belgium went bankrupt, that is, could not pay the interest on their foreign loans at various times in the 19th century. Until large-scale rural to urban migration began in mid-century, the Ottoman cities of Istanbul, Aleppo, Damascus, Izmir, Smyrna had larger populations than almost all European cities. It is, of course, true that Ottoman administration could be oppressive, and certainly in some of the remoter provinces was almost non-existent, but it was certainly not universally opposed. It was regarded as part of a more or less unchanging natural order of things to be tolerated like the weather. Another very important point needs to be mentioned. The Ottoman Empire was, in ways that are difficult to define precisely, a Muslim institution, ruling after the loss of its European provinces in 1878, peoples who were mostly Muslim. It administered Islamic law or a legal system informed by Islamic principles. Sunni Islam was the official religion of the state, although it respected the freedom of worship of non-Muslims and, in practice, rarely tried to enforce Sunni Islam on its non-Sunni Muslim population. Finally, as far as those who supported it ideologically or intellectually were concerned, the Ottoman state as an institution was all that stood between some form of independence and absorption by the European powers, as happened in Algeria, Egypt, Morocco, Tripolitania, and Tunisia by the time of the First World War. And of course, this is exactly what happened after 1918. One could not, of course, expect Gertrude Bell and her contemporaries to value the Ottoman state in its role as a bulwark against European imperial expansion, but it is worth noting that they neither viewed it in a particularly positive light, nor, with a very few exceptions, expressed any understanding of the major processes of transition that it experienced in the half century before 1900. Chapter 6 and 7 of The Desert and the Sown, based on Bell's experiences in Syria in 1904 and 1905, contain some interesting observations on Ottoman rule, Arab society, and the role of the Ottomans in Syria. First, and Bell is describing entering Damascus from the south, quote, desert life comes to within an hour or two of Damascus, and the Ottoman Sultan's peace, if peace it can be called, ceases almost at the walls of the chief city of Syria. and some oddities, but interesting in their oddness, quote, in the sense of a land inhabited mainly by Turks, there is no such a country as Turkey. The parts of his dominions where the Turk is in a majority are few. Generally, his position is that of an alien governing with a handful of soldiers and an empty purse, a mixed collection of subjects hostile to him and to each other. End of quote. This blanket description of the, quote, alien governor seems to be very much at odds with what one knows of early 20th century Ottoman provincial administration. Bell's host, the Vali Navembe, could not speak Arabic, but by the time of her visit, the considerable expansion of the bureaucracy at all levels meant that most lower-level office holders were Arabs, members of a burgeoning local land-owning aristocracy of service all over the empire, who met each other in the various provincial law schools and colleges and in Istanbul. In fact, Bell meets Rubabeg al-Abid, the Arab Qaim Maqam of Drekish, a cousin of Izzet Pasha. She goes on, and yet, quote, and yet, for all the failure, there's no one who would obviously be fitted to take his place. Of what value are the pan-Arabic associations and the inflammatory leaflets that they issue from foreign printing presses? The answer is easy. They are worth nothing at all. There is no nation of Arabs. The Syrian merchant is separated by a wider gulf from the Bedouin than he is from the Osmanli. The Syrian country is inhabited by Arabic-speaking races, all eager to be at each other's throats and only prevented from fulfilling their natural desires by the ragged, half-fed soldier who draws at rare intervals the Sultan's pay. End quote. She then visits Shakib Arsalan, whom she records as saying, quote, my friend, the evils under which we suffer are due to the foreign nations who refuse to allow the Turkish Empire to move in any direction. When she fights, they take the fruits of her victory from her, as they did after the war with the Greeks, end quote. Here, I think, without necessarily realizing it, Bell seems to have stumbled on a genuine sentiment. Arsalan is saying, we Ottomans are being prevented by the other European nations from taking our seat at the community of nations. This was a common sentiment amongst the Ottoman middle class at the time. And this expression by Arsalan illustrates the way in which intellectuals would identify with the Ottoman state. After leaving Damascus, Bell was provided with a small military escort of varying size, but usually of about half a dozen men for the rest of her journey through Syria, Baalbek, Homs, Hama, and Aleppo. This obviously indicates first the fact that the Ottoman Empire was an integrated administrative whole, and second, that the area was at peace. What I want to suggest, and I would like to develop it at greater length on another occasion, is a sense felt by locals of the community and continuity of the empire, the fact that it was and had so long been part of the local political and historical framework. The Arab Mashriq had been part of the empire since 1516 to 1517. Given that the previous government had been Turkish-speaking Mamluks, there was little obvious difference in style or governance in the years immediately after the conquest. But as I have said, it did matter that then that the Ottoman Empire was a Muslim empire, an institution that once stretched as far north as Hungary and as far south as the Sudan. It is also the case, in the run-up to the First World War, that such events as the restoration of the Ottoman constitution in 1908 or the Italian invasion of Tripolitania were occasions for widespread pro-Ottoman demonstrations in the cities of Greater Syria. Unsurprisingly, when Bell and her contemporaries asked the leaders of nomadic tribes, and these tribes were a fairly small minority of the population, even in 1900, what they thought of the Ottomans, they would profess to desire freedom or independence, whatever they thought that might mean. I'm not sure, therefore, whether the notion put forward by the, quote, Arabists to the effect that the Ottomans were deeply unpopular or that the population actively desired change actually originated. Certainly, Jamal Pasha's brutalities in Syria in 1915 to 1918, some 15 years later, did bring a tide of anti-Ottoman feeling into existence. But it is nevertheless, but it is instructive that any, that even given the realities of Ottoman military occupation, the Arab revolt, Faisal and the tribes of the Hejaz did not arouse widespread enthusiasm in Syria itself until the very end of the war, and still less in Baghdad and Basra, from which the Ottomans had been driven by early 1917. In any case, and I hope both that I am not the first to have pointed this out, and that it will be taken as constructive criticism, the Ottoman Empire as an entity, actually functioned very differently from some of the characterizations made by Georgina Howell in what is otherwise a fascinating and lively biography of Gertrude Bell. This reads very oddly, especially in the 2010s, after many decades of well-received scholarly works by others who on the Arab provinces of the empire. Quote, this is from Georgina Howell. For several hundred years, the Turks had been infiltrating, then taking over the administration of the towns and the few large cities that ring the deserts at the heart of the Middle East. The Ottoman Empire had systematically set about replacing the Sharia law, the divine laws of Islam, with their own Napoleonic laws, and had introduced Turkish as a language of administration and education. The Turks drew leading Arab figures into the Turkish web, rewarding them for loyalty, until its gentle hold on Arabia had become a vice-like grip. Howell, from her book Queen of the Desert, page 95. Such sentiments, as well as the notion later expressed by some British administrators in Iraq, that the British occupation in Iraq was somehow justified because of the poor performance of the Ottoman predecessors, should have no place in any critical evaluation of the period. In any case, the positive notion of a shared Ottoman past was part of the lived experience of a now vanished generation of Iraqis, Lebanese, Syrians, and others who grew up in the last decades of the empire.
I truly wish good health and rapid recovery for Professor Peter Sloglitz. And I also wish good luck for our young promising scholar from Turkey. We have only 20-25 minutes for a question. If anyone have a question.
Yes, thank you. Just two quick questions. If we could know a little more about Gertrude Bell's role in the creation of the National Library? And the second question, has it been confirmed that she was being paid as a spy by the British government in, when she was traveling in Saudi Arabia? Thank you.
So for your second question, I would definitely say that the no money in the Ottoman Empire just left unpaid. So if is there written in the official document, so it is just given. So I basically assure you that the money was taken. So if there is no money, it was repaid. So Gertrude Bell would definitely say that I did not get my money. She would definitely complain about it. So there is no about compilation. She also feels sorry about the people of the town because she creates so much problem when she was robbed. She became really angry and the act people very behaves angry. So then after the problem solved, she feels sorry for that and she apologized from that. So I basically assure that there is no 100% yes, I get my money from the Ottoman Empire, but the documents in the empire and also her feelings towards the empire, so definitely says that she gets her money back. So for your first question, I didn't understand. Can I? Okay.
Thank you. Regarding the National Library and Archive and even the Iraqi Museum, apart from cultural reasons, There were also political reasons to establish or to set up such a secular institution in Iraq. You know, the main opposition to the British prisons were the religious establishment. We had traditional culture, we had a traditional education system, and well, so it is extremely important to set up this modern institution and to win over the heart and the brain and the mind of the newly formed educated class in Baghdad. Indeed, she cooperated with a group of well-educated Iraqis, or some of them from Lebanon, like Father Anastas Caramelli. First, the idea was to establish a library called Al-Mustansiri Library. Then, later, they changed it to the Salam Library, which is the nickname of or name of Baghdad. So, one have to emphasize not only cultural reasons, also the political reasons, because secularism came to Iraq with the British occupation of Iraq. It was extremely important for them to offer an alternative to traditionalism in Iraq. Thank you. Any question? Yes, please.
One hears repeatedly that Gertrude Bell was a spy, and quite apart from the question of money that was the first question, although she was well connected at the highest levels, and although she wrote to people like Sir Edward Grey after her travels and so on, it may be too early to ask in this conference what people think about this, but I am unconvinced that Gertrude Bell was a spy in any official sense. She was somebody who liked writing. She reported what she saw. Did this amount to spying? Was she in any sense an official agent of the British government on the intelligence side? I personally doubt it, and if there is evidence to the contrary effect, I'd love to hear it during the conference.
I mean, I'll try to answer that. For my own opinion is that the whole profession of spying has changed since World War I. I mean, we were talking about sort of variety ace of spies. I think that she was a spy in that sense, in the sense that she relayed information that was of definite use to those major decision makers in Whitehall. Now, whether she was a salaried employee of a formal government agency, I doubt it. But I think the whole nexus of information gathering in that period probably involved the transfer and the relay of information on the ground by people who have close networks, and it then seeps, as it were, into the decision-making process. So it's how long is a piece of string? I think formally no, informally yes.
I can say that from the reading of her diaries or letters, she is not acting officially spy in that period before the World War I. So the thing that written in the Ottoman archives could be says that the period of the Abdulhamid II, the period that she travels, this is the Sultan of the period, he is really curious about what is going on around him. So he made lots of excessive research about her intention. So this could be a kind of a guess, because in the writings of the Gertrude Bell, I did not read that I am the supplier of the British Empire and I took that much money, because she don't have need of money, so she's already rich. So I don't know whether she was took this money officially, but she did not act official spy for me. She is a traveler, she is just an observer. Maybe the thing that she observes politics, but that does not make her a spy for me. So what I say in the Ottoman archives, the period of the Abdulhamid II was the period of the spies. He has also lots of spies, because, the times very in the turmoil in the Ottoman Empire. So it can be the misunderstanding of the empire, maybe. Her being like spy. The empire maybe thinks so.
Thank you. Any question?
Well, this is a matter of great detail, but possibly of interest. Gertrude Bell was evidently, from the extracts that have been read out, well aware that the Ottoman authorities were interested in her movements. How actually did she become aware? Just because sort of local policemen were asking questions, or was it rather connections at court, as you might say?
Can you repeat your question, please?
Well, Gertrude Bell was aware that the Ottoman authorities were interested in her as a suspicious character.
Yes.
How did she become aware? Simply because there were local policemen asking questions, or did she have inside information?
She was being stopped, actually. She was followed. But where she was going, says that there's a man in Damascus. What I was going to do next, he just followed me. So this is the first thing. The second thing is when she go to, I don't know, in the tribal chase in Syria, the governor of this place asked too much questions about her intention. Where you want to go? When you want to go? What do you want to do next? So you should let us know before you go anywhere. So she is the clearer woman, and she definitely thinks that I'm a suspicious one, so, yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Alibi. It's still today in Iraq, when you say Gertrude Bell, some people who know who she is different, but the idea is, oh yes, she's a spy. This is always, because when I've been working on the always people tell me, isn't she a spy? So I have to explain what it is, you know. Everyone. I don't know why they have this attitude that when you have a foreigner interested, you must be a spy.
I think during the 19th and early 20th century, all the explorer archaeologists and foreigners were considered as a spy. Not only Bell. It was part of our culture to be very suspicious of foreigners. Thank you.
But don't you think also that this was an image that she actually liked to cultivate over the years? She enjoyed that mystique, that becoming rather an enigma. And she cultivated that image. That was part of her personality. And it got her through the very difficult times in her life.
Thank you.
Yes, it is.
As a graduate of the spy school in Lebanon, it was often my experience, and I'm sure my colleagues, that the mere fact that you as a foreigner took the trouble to learn Arabic well, to study the history and geography and politics of the area, marked you out as a spy. Local people simply could not recognize that you were there to understand the people rather than to spy on them. And I think that attitude was almost certainly prevalent during Gertrude Bell's time. Why should a European woman wander around the Arab world asking questions? She must be a spy.
Absolutely right. In my opinion, every patriot is a spy of his country. Any questions, please?
What is the state of the Ottoman archives that you're looking at? I mean, where do you go to do your research? Is it in one of the libraries or one of the government? It would be quite interesting to hear, you know, the state of the archive that you're looking at.
There is a building in Istanbul. It's a very huge and very historical building. So you can just go there and type the name of the Gertrude Bell and just see all the documents just come up. So the problem about the Ottoman archives is there is a loss of documents. So as you can see, her travels started in 1889, but the documents just only came out in 1909. So there must be lots of documents about Gertrude Bell, but I just found just four ones. So it starts in 1909. So definitely there's lots of documents about her because she's a suspicious person in the Ottoman eyes. So there's an unread, unclassified document. And I'm sure in the years of 10 years later, maybe 20 years later, there are lots of documents will come up. So
good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, yes, please. I suppose that the ongoing debate about whether Bell was a spy or not, I think both speaks to the informality of her role, but also the benefit of her class position and the discrimination of her gender position. So, you know, Bell was part of, as Ali was saying, a kind of intense network of British Orientalists scattered through the Ottoman Empire. I'm taking with T.E. Lawrence's archaeological digs in quotation mark along the routes of the Berlin to Baghdad railway. Now, was he digging for archaeology or was he keeping an eye on what could be a strategic threat to Germany? But I think with Bell, this informal network of kind of Orientalist knowledge was clear, but I think that the fact that she wasn't paid for and had no formal role in a hierarchy of the British state before the beginning of the First World War would then discount her for being called a spy or even an agent of influence. Influence, yes, agent, no. But then she comes into the British hierarchy with the Arab Bureau and her positioning in Basra from 1916 onwards. But then I think you've got a duality there. She's not formally employed in a chain of hierarchy that would allow her to progress through the colonial civil service. She, her position is personal, very strong with Percy Cox, much, much less so with A.T. Wilson. And then if she is a spy with A.T. Wilson, she's a spy against him because she peppers her contacts in London saying, this man is an incompetent, get rid of him. And then her relationship with Dobbs is much less close than Bell. So in a way, I think the informality of her role, her network of key members in the British government benefit her during the Ottoman Empire and during the early stages of the occupation of Iraq, but then fade away and her influence declines. So I think it's a fascinating ambiguity that may well have been cultivated by her, but it's an ambiguity in the end of powerlessness, of informality, of lack of institutional position, not of power within the kind of colonial hierarchy, I think.
I just want to go back to the spy thing and try to perhaps contextualize it. We're talking about a period when the Ottoman Empire was in galloping retreat under attack by all kinds of foreign powers. Which, I mean, Peter mentioned it in his talk here, but in the period after 1908, after the so-called Young Turk Revolution, more territory was lost than it was lost throughout the entire Sultanate of Abd al-Hamid, and it took place in a matter of a few years. The Ottoman Empire lost most of the remaining territories it had in the Balkans. It was attacked unprovokedly in Libya or Tripolitania. So I can understand why there was this kind of fear of spies behind every corner, because any empire, any country that has been systematically eroded and degraded over a very short period of time, I'm sure if it happened to any other large territorial unit in such a short period of time, public opinion would also think that foreigners groping around and digging here and there are not necessarily doing that in order to advance objectively the field of knowledge, that they have something to do with power. So I think it is, and I'm sure Bell knew that. I'm sure Bell had an understanding that the sentiment in an empire that was under genuine and real threat, not really imagined, is one that would encourage or engender this kind of thinking. So to probe around, walk around, and sort of go on for a walkabout around the bazaars of Damascus would, I think, rightly generate suspicion, given the environment of the times.
Thank you. Just 2 weeks ago, I was at the German embassy. I discovered that during the First World War, the Germans sent a military delegation to be with the Turkish forces in the south of Iraq, and they took a lot of photographs. And they just wanted to test the water, if they will exhibit the photos of this military delegations. And they were very worried that might the Iraqis think they are spies who took photographs of Iraq, and it was a plan, a German plan, in the future they will Akshapali Anak. So everybody's worried about his image, you know, among the other people, the people who are whose land was occupied. Thank you. Question, please. We are
okay, a slightly different topic. Peter's paper brought out, I think in a very interesting way, the ungrounded nature of the characterization by many British travelers in the Ottoman Empire, that it was in some ways illegitimate, that there was a sort of a yoke that was resented by the people, this perception that the British travelers have of the Ottoman Empire that doesn't actually have very much basis in fact. Now, one can understand why after 1914 they would say that. One could understand why they would characterise the Ottoman Empire in that way. But could I invite the panellists to reflect on why before they might think that about the Ottoman Empire?
My reading of the period is that sometime around the late 19th century, especially in the so-called Bulgarian massacres, public opinion shifted. And there was a very powerful lobby in parliament that was arranged against the Ottoman Empire, which historically had been, Britain's policy had been historically to preserve the empire. And the various other quote-unquote massacres that took place, I put it in quotes because I think historically they have not been substantiated, have also played a very large part in moving, as it were, public opinion, especially in this country, against the Ottoman Empire. Mark Sykes, for example, in his early days, was very much a pro-Ottoman figure. But then, sometime around 1910, I think, when he became an MP, the whole thing changed. So there was, I think, a constituency, a growing constituency, that did not see the empire as a kind of bulwark against Russian expansionism and so on. And that affected opinion. I think it affected the policy also.
Yes, we have last question, please. Yeah. Gentlemen. No, this one. Yes.
At the risk of being provocative, especially to those who are deeply in love with Gertrude Bell and the mythology surrounding it, let me suggest that isn't this a classic case of the English amateur? It seems to me now there are others here who know better with regard to archaeology. It seems to me she did know something about archaeology. As a writer and journalist myself, I think she knew a hell of a lot about language and literature. She had a real talent for words. The question arises whether she was an amateur or a specialist, so to speak, in those interconnected realms of politics, intelligence, and war. I suggest the jury should be out.
Thank you. Yes. This lady, please.
And the impression I get for her evading the Ottoman authorities is almost like an adrenaline rush. She knew they were after her, but their main interest initially was probably for her safety, and it would just be an embarrassment to have her killed in the desert. And I think she then played on it, and she was delighted that she'd become a person, is what she writes in her diaries. And so it became like it's a cat and mouse. And, you know, then one thing led to another, but I think that's how one should see it.
Okay, thank you. So my idea of the Iraqi security is that forces under Saddam Hussein, when they monitored people's activities, they said, want to be sure of your safety.
Exactly. I mean, everywhere you work in Arabia, I mean, be it Iraq, Yemen, you always have a tail. When I lived in Baghdad, I just felt much safer having a tail because I knew if I broke down, you know, Ali and Mohammed would come and rescue me, so it didn't matter.
I'll ask a question, please.
Isn't the fact that she was basically an inveterate risk-taker, addicted to risk? I mean, you only need to read about her quite extraordinary, hair-raising mountaineering exploits, you know, with a total lack of equipment that we now have, and what she did. I mean, she found herself although she had two extremely experienced alpine guides, she found herself in situations which, quite frankly, are mind-boggling in terms of, like, I mean, her life was threatened. I mean, it was nearly cut short by her mountaineering exploits. And then again, when she got to the desert, she seemed to be intent on going to the most dangerous places. And there is this aspect of her personality. It's almost an addiction to risk.
Thank you. Do you have any comment there? I think that's it. That's it, and thank you for the panelists, and thank you for your attention. Thank you very much.
Just let you all know that in the other room, we have some panels up that John Long brought, and we also have a DVD that's going with moving slides that Mark Jackson has done from the University of Newcastle. So when you have your coffee and or during lunch break, when we have it, is you go off, but when you come back, you can go in the room and take a look at all these things. And coffee's